Well, today we're going to start a new series in our morning worship services. This is going to be a series on the book of Acts, and Acts is such an important book. And we're talking today about what an intelligent, gracious, and unearthly, supernatural religion we have in the Christian faith. It is so wonderful. It is so intelligent. It is so gracious. It is so supernatural. And, of course, the book of Acts is all about this. Every part of that title, you know, it's so intelligent, the workings of Acts and the writings of Luke, which we'll talk about today. So intelligent, so gracious. There's just so much love all involved here and so supernatural. The book of Acts, you know, is top. So we're going to spend a good little while in the book of Acts. And today we're going to start just introducing the topic, introduce you to the person of Luke. And we're going to give you a taste for how intelligent and gracious and unearthly our Christian faith really is. The book of Acts is actually part two of a two-part history of the early church and the Christian faith. Part one is what we call the Gospel of Luke. That's obviously about the history of Jesus' life on earth. That's one volume. Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke. And then Luke wrote the second volume, which is the book of Acts. And the book of Acts is a history of the earliest Christians. And together, Luke and Acts, you know, those are fairly long books in the New Testament. When you put them together, volume one and volume two, put them together, they comprise more than a fourth of the entire New Testament. So Luke is a very important writer to the New Testament. He does one fourth all by himself. And just to give you an idea of that, in a typical New Testament like mine, the Gospel of Luke is 46 pages long, volume one. And the book of Acts is 46 pages long, volume 2. And so altogether, that's 92 pages in my Bible. And the New Testament has about 400 pages. And so one-fourth of that is all Luke. And that compares favorably with what Paul wrote. So if you think that Paul wrote Hebrews as well as the other 13 Pauline epistles, then Paul wrote 97 pages and Luke wrote 92. So almost the same, right? So Luke is a very, very important writer of the New Testament. And if you say, well, what's the book of Acts all about? It's really quite simple. You're going to spend the first 12 chapters talking about Jerusalem and the Jerusalem apostles. That's it. Everything that takes place in Jerusalem. When you get to chapter 13 and continue through the period of Paul, that's most of chapter 21, then you're going to talk all about Paul. And no longer in Jerusalem very much. It's all Paul and all around the world. So the first part, 1 through 12, Jerusalem. 13 through 21, Paul and around the world. And then we just have some things to clean up. Paul gets arrested, and we have to talk about his arrest and imprisonment. And that's going to be chapter 21 through 26. And then just bring it to a close, Paul's 2 years in prison, chapters 27 and 28, including a long voyage to Rome. So that's what the book of Acts is about. And you'll see that it is in two volumes. And interesting, did you notice that they're approximately the same length? There is evidence that it was only convenient to make a scroll a certain length. And it looks like Luke had two identical leather scrolls and he filled them both up. So they're almost the same. Volume one, volume two. And you see, the opening to Luke says, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you in order, most excellent Theophilus. We'll talk about Theophilus in just a minute. And volume two is almost the same, right? The former treatise, you know, scroll one, the former treatise I have made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began to do and teach. So we have volume one, volume two in Luke and Acts. When was Acts written? Well, Acts records about 30 years of history. From the ascension of Jesus, which is about 32 AD, until the end of Paul's Roman imprisonment, which is about 62. So about 30 years. And you say, but when was it actually written? Well, here's what we know. This is a history book, right? The book of Acts is a history book. And the fall of Jerusalem is not mentioned. That took place in 70 AD. Well, there's no way a history book is not going to mention the fall of Jerusalem in a Christian history, because that was just so important. So clearly, Acts was written before 70 AD, or it would have mentioned it. Since it didn't mention it, it means it was written before 70 AD. Furthermore, we think that Paul would have been killed for his faith in about 68 AD. And absolutely, Luke would have mentioned that in the book of Acts if it had happened, but it hadn't happened. So clearly, the book of Acts had to be written before Paul died, which was about 68. And then furthermore, in 64 AD was the great fire of Rome, when Nero blamed the Christians for setting Rome on fire. Well, if that had happened, surely the book of Acts would have recorded it, but it's not in the book of Acts, and that means Acts was completed before 64 AD. So we know that Acts was written before 64 AD. What about this fellow Theophilus? Why did Luke write volume 1 and volume 2, Luke and Acts, to Theophilus? Why? And he did write to Theophilus, right? Because it says in Luke 1:3, seemed good to me to write to you, most excellent Theophilus. In chapter 1 of Acts, the former treatise I have made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began to preach and do. Well, Theophilus, the name means lover of God, which is a nice name. There were lots of Theophiluses in the world. Our joke when I was a kid was, oh, you should name your baby Theophilus. Oh, why Theophilus? Because that's the awfulest baby I ever saw. So you'll remember Theophilus. There's a common name in the Roman days, and this particular Theophilus must have been a personal friend or supporter of some kind for Luke. So Luke has a special attachment to this fellow. Somehow we don't know how. The term most excellent, because it's most excellent Theophilus. Most excellent is a term for dignitaries. And so Theophilus was kind of a big shot. And some people say maybe Theophilus became a Christian by reading Luke and Acts. Maybe so, but we have no evidence of that. More likely, Theophilus was a person who was in a position to support and defend the early church. So Luke is saying, Theophilus, you are a dignitary, most excellent Theophilus. You're a dignitary, and you are in a position to help us. So I want you to have all the facts. So Luke and Acts go to Theophilus. All right, good. Why did Luke write it? Well, he tells us. He says, it seemed good. He says, it seemed good to me. It seemed good to him to write the book of Acts, since he had what he calls perfect understanding of all that happened from the very first days of Jesus. So your favorite Christmas story, you know, the first days of Jesus here in this world. Your favorite Christmas story is what Linus quoted on the Charlie Brown Christmas special from Luke chapter 2. They were in the same country, shepherds abiding in the field. You like that. Luke says, I know all about that. I know everything from the earliest days. So that's why he decided to write it. He states that many others have also taken in hand. Taken in hand meaning take a pen in your hand, a quill in your hand, and a leather scroll in your hand. Many others have taken in hand to write a history of Jesus. Others have already done that in order. I'm not the first one to do this. Others have done it as well. And he says they are telling us all the remarkable deeds that have been fulfilled. Like, you just can't believe all the unearthly things that have happened in the history of Jesus. Others have done this, and I am doing it as well. He specifically refers to eyewitnesses who have seen and heard what Jesus preached and what Jesus did. And he's counting on them as his sources. I'm going to tell you what you can rely upon, what you can depend upon, because these are coming from reliable, credible eyewitnesses. And then he says that he felt compelled to write in an orderly way all the things because he was in a position to understand them. You say, okay, well, why was he in a position to understand them? All right, good question. Luke was not a disciple of Jesus. He didn't follow Jesus around. As a matter of fact, Luke evidently doesn't come to the Christian faith until 20 years after Calvary. He's a latecomer to the Christian party. So what makes him so smart about everything? Well, as a fellow traveling companion of Paul, and he was that, and so also was John Mark. They were in Paul's life often, and so in Paul's life together. So here's Luke, who wrote the Gospel of Luke, and Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark, and they're traveling with Paul from time to time. They know each other very well, and they'd be constantly exchanging notes on what Jesus said. Did you hear what this eyewitness said? Did you hear what that eyewitness said? And so they're constantly comparing notes back and forth. So Mark and Luke are buddies, and they're talking to each other. Well, you can see when you're reading Luke's gospel, which is longer than Mark's gospel, quite a lot longer. But you see that Luke includes 169, what you might call paragraphs or pericopes, sections of the gospel of Mark. 169 sections of the gospel of Mark are moved over to the gospel of Luke, and Mark has 56 others, 223 altogether. But Luke is using a lot of the same information as Mark, and their gospels are very similar in all of those 169 places. Also remember that since Luke is a traveling companion to Paul, he and Paul are constantly talking. So everything Paul knows, Luke is hearing and writing down. And furthermore, all of Paul's friends. So everywhere you go, you're running into Christian people, some of whom knew Jesus personally. And so Luke is with Paul, hearing all these things from John Mark, from Paul, from all the friends of Paul. He really is in a position to know the life of Christ and the history of the early church. How did Luke learn these things, and how did he have time to write all of this? Well, we know that when Paul was arrested in Jerusalem toward the end of his life, this is 57 or so, Paul is arrested and he doesn't go immediately to trial. You might say he rots in jail for 2 years before he finally goes to Rome for sentencing. Well, as he's rotting in Caesarea in jail for 2 years, Luke is constantly visiting him, and Luke has time to write. And so Luke is undoubtedly doing that. And we realize, excuse me, that in some ways, Luke isn't hardly mentioned in the New Testament. As a matter of fact, we know he's only mentioned by name 3 times. And here are the 3 times. In Colossians 4:14, it says, excuse me, Luke, the beloved physician, greets you. So here we find out he is the beloved physician. In Philemon, verse 24, there's only one chapter. Philemon, verse 24, says, there salute you Marcus, we'd say Mark. Marcus and Lucas, we'd say Luke. See, they were together a lot. They were buddies, Mark and Luke. There salute you Marcus and Lucas, my fellow laborers. And so Luke is mentioned there. And one more time, in 2 Timothy 4:11, we have Paul at the very end of his life. He's about ready to die. And he says, only Luke is still with me. Only Luke is here. And so the mention of the name Luke doesn't just come up all the time in the New Testament. But interestingly, we have these, what we call the we passages of the book of Acts. You read along in the book of Acts, it says, Paul and his traveling companions, they did such and such a thing. And Paul and his traveling companions, they did such and such a thing. And then all of a sudden it's we did such and such a thing. Like, hey, why'd you switch from they to we? The answer is because now Luke is traveling with Paul. And so we have these we passages in the New Testament. And basically, these we passages sound like this. Paul on his second missionary tour. And you have to remember, his first missionary tour is going to a place in Turkey called Galatia. He spends most of his time in Galatia. His second missionary tour is where he's going to meet Luke. Second missionary tour is basically all about Europe. The gospel comes to Europe. That's a really big deal. Because when you read about Paul being in Corinth on his second missionary tour, he's in Corinth for 1.5 years. That's his main stopover. So for 1.5 years, he's in Corinth. You say, okay, so that's Corinth. No, but you would call it Greece. He's in Greece. You know Greece is in Europe, right? So most of that time, he's in Corinth/Greece. So the second missionary tour is a European tour. And as Paul tries to go into other places in Turkey again, the Lord says no. And then there's this, what we call the Macedonian vision. Macedonia exists today as a nation in Europe. There's this Macedonian call. And Paul wants to go to Turkey. And the answer is no, you can't go to Turkey. And finally, in a vision, God says, you have to go to Europe. So he goes to Europe. And the moment he goes to Europe, he meets Luke. Luke is in Europe. They stop over very quickly in 2 places, Samothracia and Neapolis, but just like one day, and they get right down to Philippi. Philippi is where there's going to be the first ever European church. The gospel has come to Europe, and now there's a church in Europe, and Luke is there. So all of a sudden, when the gospel goes to Europe, Luke says, and we did this and we did that. And there it is in Philippi. And they were there certain days. We don't know how many days, but remember, it went kind of badly because Paul and Silas were cast into prison. They healed the demon-possessed girl, and the people who owned her services were mad because now she couldn't tell fortunes. So they beat Paul and Silas, which they were not allowed to do. There's no Roman law about converting a demon-possessed girl. They should not have beaten them. They should not have put them in jail. Earthquake at night. The jailer becomes a Christian, remember it all. And then the town council has to come and apologize to Paul and Silas. And they leave Philippi. Who does not leave with them? Luke. So now all of a sudden, the Acts narrative changes from we to they. They departed. And we don't hear from Luke again until the third missionary tour. Evidently, Luke stayed in Philippi for 6 or 7 years. So Paul and Silas left, but Luke stays. On the third missionary tour, Paul, toward the end of the third missionary tour, Paul comes back to Philippi. And who does he find there? Luke. And now it's time for Paul to go to Jerusalem after the third missionary tour. He's going to go to Jerusalem, and it's going to be very bad there. Luke is going to go with him every step of the way from now on. They go to Jerusalem. There's a riot. The people started beating Paul. The Roman soldiers see there's this big dust up down there by the temple. And so they run down. They intervene to keep them from killing Paul because they were just about ready to kill Paul. They take Paul, arrest him, and that starts his 2 years in a Caesarean jail. And Luke is with him every step of the way. So it's always we from that point forward. And as far as we know, Luke stays with Paul for the rest of his life. And so Luke and Paul are partners for the rest of Paul's life. All right. Who is this Luke? Luke is a Greek-cultured Jew. In Colossians 4, 10 through 11, there are three people named Aristarchus, Marcus, and Justus as Paul's only fellow workers of the circumcision. That is, my only Jewish fellow workers. And those three are Aristarchus, Marcus, and Justus. And Luke isn't there. And so some people say, oh, well, that proves that Luke was a Gentile because he wasn't listed with the Jewish people who were Paul's fellow workers. But that's overstating the situation. These Jewish Christians, Aristarchus, Marcus, Justus, were probably singled out for a different reason, not just because of their Jewishness, but for some other reason. Because we know Paul had a lot more Jewish friends than that who were fellow workers. So he only named those three, and we don't know why, but you shouldn't conclude from that that Luke is a Gentile. Additionally, we find that Luke's Jewish writings and his writings, the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts, are very Jewish in their orientation. They sound Jewish. And some scholars have said, you know what, his natural speech is, Luke's natural speech is Jewish Greek. He's very Jewish. So some people say, oh, Luke was a Gentile. But no, his writing style is Jewish Greek. He isn't a normal Gentile. He's a Jewish Greek person. And then when we're reading over there in Romans chapter 3, verse 2, we're reminded that to the Jewish people were committed the oracles of God. That's what it says. Unto them were committed the oracles of God. Oracles are the speeches of God, the scriptures. And so Paul says, you know, all the writers of the Bible are Jewish. Willie Nelson said, my heroes have always been cowboys. For us, our heroes have always been Jewish. All of our heroes are Jewish. And all the Bible writers are Jewish. If there was an exception, Luke would be that exception. But there's no reason to jump to that exception. It does appear that all the writers of Scripture are Jewish, even Luke, although some people say he's Gentile. All right, now I just have to tell you three really sweet things about Luke. The third thing I'm going to tell you is for every other sermon after today. So in a way, I'm only going to tell you two sweet things about Luke, but you have to know the third one is coming in spades. All right, the first thing about Luke is his intelligence. Remember, we're calling this sermon the intelligent, gracious, unearthly religion of Jesus Christ. And that is the faith that we love and the Savior we serve. We want to talk about the intelligence of Luke, which is very exciting to talk about. Remember, in Colossians 4:4, Paul was writing to his friends at Colossae. He says, "And Luke, the beloved physician, sends his greeting." Luke is a physician. Luke is a doctor. So Luke is an intelligent guy. He is a medical man. And in those days, of course, that required special training, special education. And there was a special respect for a medical man. Luke is that. He's very intelligent. He's also very intelligent with language. Now, if you have ever studied Greek at all, and I am certainly no Greek scholar, but I can pick up words. Like when I'm reading in the Gospel of John, which is the easiest because John was just a fisherman, right? So if I'm reading the Gospel of John, I can look at a verse and say, I think I know what he's saying there, and I want to double check. I read Greek like a four-year-old or a kindergartner. Like, I think I know what that word is. I think I have the idea, but I might be wrong. I have to double check with the experts. But when I come to the Gospel of Luke, or especially the book of Acts, I have no idea what's going on. If you have any language training, you can read the Gospel of John like, okay. And Luke, or especially Acts, like, I don't know. I don't know what he's talking about. I don't get it. He's hard. He has all these technical words. If you learn 5,000 words in the Greek language, you've got basically the whole New Testament. You know what a pleasure that is. So nice that the Lord decided to write the New Testament in Greek, because you only have to know 5,000 words. You know how many words we have in English? About 300,000. So believe me, you want to learn Greek rather than English if it comes to choices. You learn 5,000 words in Greek and you have the New Testament. But when you come, there are these lists like, this word is used in the Greek New Testament 100 times. And this word is used in the Greek New Testament 50 times. And then you get to, this word is used in the Greek New Testament once. Oh, who wrote that? Luke. Always. Oh, this one occurs twice. Who did that? Luke. Always just Luke. It's the hardest. He's a genius. And you think, well, I can't really see that in English. But believe me, you can sure see it in Greek, because I have no idea what he's saying. He is a language expert. Geography. Luke has a rare grasp of the Roman Mediterranean world. I mean, you can imagine, how likely is it that anybody travels like the Apostle Paul traveled? But Luke traveled with the Apostle Paul for 5 years, bouncing all over the Mediterranean Sea in a ship, and also walking. And he has a grasp of geography, and like, okay, Luke, you are the man. You are a smart guy. Travel, a rare understanding of sailing ships and their routes. Do you know, if any of you are aviators, you know, but do you all know what is the best way to fly a jumbo jet from Europe to the United States? You know, you don't just fly straight across. They do this big arc. Nobody would know that. I mean, pilots know, aviators know that. But nobody would guess that. Well, that's what Luke does. If he was just making stuff up, think, oh, I know, he wants to get from here to here. Here's how he's going to do it. Like, nope. Luke will take a better route, a shipping route that was known in antiquity that we don't really know about. And every once in a while, smart Alex in the 1800s would say, Luke has no idea what he's doing because he took a crazy route. And then we did all the history and archaeology, and we found out that the critics were wrong. Luke did exactly what the people in the ancient world did, and there were reasons that they did it, and Luke knows those reasons. So he knows all about travel. He knows all about history. He is correct in his use of medical terms and nautical terms and geopolitical situations. He just understands the ancient world, and he's traveled everywhere. So archaeologist Sir William Ramsay, and we're going to talk more about him in just a minute, he said, Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he should be placed among the very greatest of historians. So Luke is a smart guy. He is so intelligent. Here's the most important thing you can ever learn in life. This is true. Never bet against the Bible. If you only learn that at Avalon Hills Bible Church, you've learned a good thing. Never, never bet against the Bible. If the Bible says it's so, don't bet against that. You're going to lose. And sometimes people have bet against the Bible. Particularly, they bet against Luke because they thought, here we can nail him because he's being too specific. We'll show all the places where he's wrong. Researcher Colin Hammer, he identified 84 technical details in the book of Acts that have been confirmed by historical and archaeological research. For example, Luke knew the correct ports and shipping lanes in the Roman world. That's pretty impressive. If you were just spinning a yarn, for example, when Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon, and he's just ad-libbing, and he says, well, you know, there was this place up in New York, and there was this other place down in South America, and he's just shooting from the hip. He's ad-libbing. And you will never be able to find the places he's talking about on a map because there is no such place. When Luke says a certain place exists on a map, you can take that to the bank. And he knows where the ports are correctly, and he knows the shipping lanes of the Roman world. He uses technical terminology for sailing. Like, this guy has clearly been yachting in the Mediterranean. He knows what he's doing. He uses correct terminology for obscure political officers. People have said, what is he talking about? There aren't even those kind of politicians in the Roman world. And then upon further review, oh, actually, we found the Vardar Arch in Thessalonica, and it mentioned the same guy that Luke did. Like, oh, we stand corrected. Correct geographical details for obscure locations. Correct weather conditions for travelers. He knows when to travel and what the weather conditions are likely to be. Correct details about the various superstitions and speech peculiarities in the Roman world. So he says, we went over to such and such a place and they worshipped that particular god and they spoke with this kind of a dialect. It's like, yeah, it's true. He's right about that. He's traveled. So we mentioned Sir William Ramsay a little while ago. It's such a great story, and this will give you an idea of the intellectual quality of this wonderful person, Luke. So we're back in the early 1900s now, and this is when the wise guys were saying Luke can't be trusted. And in Germany, there's a school called the Tübingen School, and they were always the ones who hated the New Testament more than anybody else. And Sir William Ramsay has been studying under the Tübingen critics, and so, you know, he just has assimilated that in his college years. It's just the way he thought. So he says, the Acts of the Apostles had to be read anew because that's going to be his field of expertise. Sir William Ramsay says, I want to know everything about Eurasia from, you know, the earliest days until the New Testament days. I want to know everything about, so I have to read the book of Acts. I mean, I just have to because the book of Acts is part of the reading material. So he said, the Acts of the Apostles had to be read anew. I began to do so without expecting any information of value. It's just the Bible. I dutifully accepted the current opinion, and this is important. This is the current opinion. This is what all of the smart guys were saying. I dutifully accepted the current opinion that the book of Acts was written by an author who wished not to present a trustworthy picture of facts, but to produce a carefully colored account, like Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. We're just spinning yarns. Luke cared nothing for geographical or historical surroundings. Antiquarian or geographical truth was less than valueless in his design like this. He doesn't care about historicity like Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. It just doesn't matter. Such was the commonly accepted view in the critical school. It's just the way the author was trained. William Ramsay just expected that Luke is not a good author. At the end he says, and the book of Acts was regarded as the weakest part of the New Testament. The book of Acts is just valueless. That's the way he thought. But then he got to researching. He thought he found a mistake in the book of Acts about one of these locations. It would be like somebody saying, the illustration that William Ramsay actually used was this. What if somebody told you met, say, a homeless guy, And the homeless guy said he was in Chicago, and the people there in Chicago abused him. And so he knew he had to escape. And what if he told you, I went from Chicago and escaped to Illinois? You would immediately say, hey, this story is not true, because Chicago is in Illinois. You can't escape Chicago and run off to Illinois. That's meaningless. Well, they thought they found Luke saying that in the book of Acts. He was saying that they were in some little place and escaped to the big place. And William Ramsey said, gotcha. And he kept researching it. He thought, oh no, the borders had moved and Luke was right after all. So that was behind his further research as he began just to shred Luke in the book of Acts and figure him out. He said, I found that my prepossessions and preformed opinions were wrong. At this point, we're describing what reasons and arguments changed the mind of one who began under the impression that the history was written long after the events and that it was untrustworthy as a whole. He said, I thought Acts was written like way later and Luke had no idea what he was talking about. I was wrong. And at the end he says, further study of Acts 13 through 21 showed that the book could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority for the facts of the Aegean world. He says, how far can we believe this narrative? How much can you believe in the book of Acts? How far can we believe this narrative? The present writer takes the view that Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect of its trustworthiness. The supposition of his accuracy ought to be admitted universally. You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment. Acts may justly be quoted as a trustworthy historical authority. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he is possessed of the true historic sense. In short, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. Luke is very intelligent. The Christian faith is very intelligent. And here's our rule of thumb again. Never, never bet against Luke. And never bet against anything in the Bible. You will lose. But we have to say something before we stop of the graciousness of Luke. Luke was such a wonderful person. You definitely do want to know Luke. When you go to heaven, you're going to like him very much. I'm sure you'll like everybody in heaven very much. But you would have loved him very much if you met him here in this world too. You know, think about this. Why would a person like Luke seek medical work? Why stop being a doctor? What's going on in his mind? And why would an eloquent and highly cultured Greek Jew with friends like most excellent Theophilus, I mean, he's allowed to speak to dignitaries when he wants to. So why would a medical doctor who has friends who are dignitaries, why would he get mixed up with riots and persecutions and shipwrecks? What did he have on his mind? Luke was so sensitive. He's such a good-hearted person. He uniquely tells the stories. When you're reading for the Gospels, some of your favorite stories come from Luke only. For example, Jesus' raising of the widow's son. Jesus says, weep not. I got this. I mean, it's such a poignant thing, you know? You just hate when your loved ones die. And Luke says, we definitely have to have that in the narrative of Jesus' life. Matthew doesn't have it. Mark doesn't have it. John doesn't have it. Luke says, that right there touches my heart, and we're including it. The sinful woman's anointing of Jesus' feet. Your sins are forgiven. She loves much because she's been forgiven much. We have to include that in the biography of Jesus. We have to. Not Matthew, not Mark, just Luke. The life of Mary Magdalene when she was demonized. Now, in all fairness, Mark mentions this too. But what a story that Mary Magdalene, who among women was probably Jesus' closest follower, she started demon-possessed of seven demons. And Luke says, oh, we're definitely including that. The Good Samaritan. Even now, we can go out to our neighbors all over America and say, have you ever heard of the Good Samaritan? I mean, who even knows what a Samaritan is out there in the world? But we could go to a middle school and say, have you ever heard of the Good Samaritan? They'll say, yeah, we know about that. Even if they've never been in church. Everybody knows the story of the Good Samaritan. Only Luke tells us about it. Not Matthew, not Mark, not John. The demon-possessed woman with dystonia. She was drawn up and she could not stretch herself. Demon-possessed. And Jesus calls her to him. Luke says, oh, I'm a medical doctor. She's all withered and drawn up. We're definitely including that. The prodigal son. One of the best known stories in the Christian faith. Known everywhere. Even by unbelievers. Only Luke. Not Matthew, not Mark, not John. Only Luke. He said, oh, we're definitely including that one. The story of Lazarus in hell, in paradise, in Abraham's bosom. Only Luke said, that's a powerful story. We have to include that in Jesus' biography. The repentant publican, he says, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Luke says, that touches me. I see the humanness of that, the humanity of that. That's going in my gospel for sure. Zacchaeus, isn't that great? Zacchaeus wanted to see Jesus, but he could not because he was little. Oh, you know, so the underdog. Luke says, that will be in my story. Definitely, we're going to include that in the biography of Jesus. The repentant thief, today you'll be with me in paradise. Are you glad that verse exists? Luke was. He said, that's going to my gospel. He's just so sensitive. Some of the favorite parts of Scripture that have the most emotional attachment to you are from Luke, because he's such a sensitive person. He's such a good guy. So we ask, you know, why you leave being a medical doctor and start following Paul around, and you're just going to be subjected to riots and persecutions and shipwrecks. Why are you going to do that? Like, I have to, because I love people. Luke had other options in life. Paul and Silas left Philippi, right? They're beaten, put in jail, earthquake, jailer becomes a Christian. The town council comes, apologizes, and escort Paul and Silas away from all the trouble. And they say, good riddance, because Philippi, an important city, has such corruption. So they leave, but Luke doesn't leave. He could have left, but he didn't. And he stays and helps with the first church that was ever in Europe. And he stays there for 6 or 7 years. He had other options. He could have been arrested with Paul. He goes to Paul when Paul is at Jerusalem in the riot and they're going to beat Paul to death. Luke is there. And then they arrest Paul and he rots in a Caesarean jail for 2 years. And Luke is still there. He could have left. He didn't have to stay. Paul was forced to travel to Rome on a ship during bad weather. Everybody said, you shouldn't go. But they're in a hurry to get Paul to Rome for his trial, so they go. And Luke gets on the ship too. And it was past shipping season, and he knew it. He got on too. He didn't have to. He had options. Paul had to. Paul's a prisoner. Luke was not a prisoner. When Paul is forced to leave home, be in Rome for 2 years in chains, well, Luke stayed with him the whole time, evidently. Luke didn't have to stay, but he did. He chose to stay. And then finally, when Paul was about ready to die, he said, at my first answer, no man stood with me. Everybody ran away. I have like no friends around here anymore. He says, but Luke is still here. Luke is just so good. He's so good. Luke himself makes himself small. I mean, you'd never know it by reading his works, how important he is. But how many times as a doctor must he have helped and nursed Paul and other Christians back to health? Here is Paul beaten and jailed at Philippi, you know, the first European church, and Luke is there. I'm sure Luke is tending to the wounds of Paul and Silas. When Paul is beaten by rioters, they were going to kill him, but the dust up was seen by the guards. The guards rush in, take him away. And Luke probably had to fix Paul up after that. And when they were shipwrecked on the island on the way to Roman imprisonment, Luke probably helped Paul and fixed him up after that. And when Paul was old and he's cold in the Mamertine jail in Rome and he'll be beheaded pretty soon, Luke is still with him, taking care of him however he can. And yet, as important as Luke must have been, he never mentions being of any particular help to Paul or anybody else. Like all true Christian influencers, Luke was beloved, right? Colossians 4:14, Luke the beloved. He's such a good guy. Luke, the beloved physician, sends his greetings. And like all true Christian influencers, he's the last one standing for the underdog. Only Luke is still here. He'll just always be around, won't he? Always faithful. So, all of us are like Luke. We are all Luke. The Christian faith is like Luke. In 246 AD, Cyprian, a new Christian, recently baptized, is writing to his friend Donatus in the Roman Empire, right? And here's what Donatus says, what Cyprian says in his letter to Donatus. He says, "It is a bad world, Donatus, an incredibly bad world. But I have discovered in the midst of it a quiet and good people who have learned the great secret of life. They found a joy in wisdom which is 1,000 times better than any of the pleasures of our sinful life. They are despised and persecuted, but they care not. They are masters of their souls. They have overcome the world." These people, Donatus, are Christians, and I am one of them. So here's our conclusion. The Christian faith is unparalleled for its intelligence and its graciousness and its unearthly supernatural power. And the Bible is unparalleled as a repository, a storehouse of intelligence and graciousness and spiritual power. And Luke was made an intelligent and gracious and powerful person by the power of Christ. And all ardent followers of Jesus are like Luke. And you're like Luke if you just follow Jesus, right?